Page 263. Here we have a flagrant example of what it means to supply a productive apparatus without changing it. To change it would have meant to overthrow another of the barriers, to transcend another of the antitheses which fetter the production of intellectuals. In this case, the barrier between writing and image. What we require of the photographer is the ability to give his picture the caption which wrenches it from modish commerce and gives its revolutionary use value. But we shall make this demand most emphatically when we, the writers, take up photography. Here too, therefore, technical progress is for the author, as producer, the foundation of this political progress. In other words, only by transcending the specialization in the process of production, which in the bourgeois view constitutes its order, is this production made politically valuable, and the limits imposed by specialization must be breached jointly by both the productive forces, and they were set up to divide. The author, as producer, discovers, in discovering his solidarity with the proletariat, that simultaneity with certain other producers who earlier seemed scarcely to concern him. I have spoken of the photographer. I shall very briefly insert a word on the musician that we have from Eisler. In the development of music, too, both in production and in reproduction, we must learn to perceive an ever-increasing process of rationalization. The gramophone, record, the sound, film, jukebox can provide top-quality music, canned as a commodity. The consequence of this process of rationalization is that musical reproduction is consigned to ever diminishing but also ever more highly qualified groups of specialists. The crisis of the commercial concert is the crisis of an antiquated form of production made obsolete by new technical inventions. The task, therefore, consisted of an Umfunktionierung of the form of the concert that had to fulfill two conditions: to eliminate the antithesis, first between performers and listeners, and second between technique and content. And this, Eisler makes the following illuminating observation. One must beware of overestimating orchestral music and considering it the only high art. Music without words gained its great importance and its full extent only under capitalism. This means that the task of changing the concert is impossible without the collaboration of the world. It alone can effect the transformation, as Eisler formulates it, of a concert into a political meeting. But that such a transformation does indeed represent a peak of musical and literary technique, Brecht and Eisler prove with the didactic play the measures taken. Page 264. If you look back from this vantage point on the recasting of literary forms that I spoke of earlier, you can see how photography and music and whatever else occurs to you are entering the growing molten mass from which they form the new form as cast. You find it confirmed that only the literarization of all the conditions of life provides a correct understanding of the extent of this melting down process, just as the state of the class struggle determines the temperature at which, more or less perfectly, it is accomplished. I spoke of the procedure of a certain modish photography whereby poverty is made an object of consumption, in turning to new matter-of-factness as a literary movement. I must take a step further and say that it has made the struggle against poverty an object of consumption. The political importance of the movement was indeed exhausted in many cases by the conversion of revolutionary reflexes, insofar as they occurred in the bourgeoisie into objects of amusement which found their way without difficulty into the big city cabaret business. The transformation of the political struggle from a compulsion to decide into an object of contemplative enjoyment, from a means of production into a consumer article, is the defining characteristic of this literature. A perceptive critic has explained this, using the example of Erich Kästner as follows. With the workers' movement, this left-wing radical intelligentsia has nothing in common. It is rather as a phenomenon of bourgeois decomposition, a counterpart of the feudalistic disguise which the Second Empire admired in the reserve officer. The radical left publicists of the stamp of Kästner, Mehring, or Tucholsky are the proletarian camouflage of decayed bourgeois strata. Their function is to produce, from the political standpoint, not parties but cliques, from the literary standpoint, not schools but fashions, from the economic standpoint, not producers but agents. Agents or hacks who make a great display of their poverty, and a banquet of yawning emptiness. One could not be more totally accommodated in an uncozy situation. This school, I said, made a great display of its poverty. It thereby shirked the most urgent task of the present-day writer to recognize how poor he is and how poor he has to be in order to begin again from the beginning. For that is what is involved. The Soviet state will not, it is true, banish the poet like Plato, but it will, and this is why I recalled the Platonic state at the outset, assign him tasks which do not permit him to display in new masterpieces the long since counterfeit wealth of creative personality. Page 265. To expect a renewal in terms of such personalities in such works is a privilege of fascism, which gives rise to such scatterbrained formulations as that which Günter Gründel, in his Mission of the Young Generation, rounds off the section on literature. We cannot better conclude this survey and prognosis than with the observation that the Wilhelm Meister and the Queen Henry of our generation have not yet been written. Nothing will be farther from the author who has reflected deeply on the conditions of present-day production than to expect or desire such works. His work will never be merely work on products, but always at the same time on the means of production. In other words, his product must have, over and above their character as works, an organizing function, and in no way must their organizational usefulness be confined to their value as propaganda. Their political tendency alone is not enough. The excellent Lichtenberg has said, "A man's opinions are not what matters, but the kind of man these opinions make of him." Now it is true that opinions matter greatly, but the best are of no use if they make nothing useful out of those who have them. The best political tendency is wrong if it does not demonstrate the attitude with which it is to be followed. And this attitude the writer can only demonstrate in his particular activity, that is, in writing. A political tendency is the necessary, never the sufficient condition of the organizing function of a work. This further requires a directing, instructing stance on the part of the writer. And today this is to be demanded more than ever before. An author who teaches writers nothing teaches no one. What matters, therefore, is the exemplary character of production, which is able first to induce other producers to produce and second to put an improved apparatus at their disposal. And this apparatus is better the more consumer it is able to turn into producers, that is, readers or spectators into collaborators. We already possess such an example, to which, however, I can only allude here. It is the epic theater of Brecht. Tragedies and operas are constantly being written that apparently have a well tried theatrical apparatus at their disposal, while in reality they do nothing but supply one that is derelict. The lack of clarity about their situation that prevails among musicians, writers, and critics, says Brecht, has immense consequences that are far too little considered. For thinking that they are in possession of an apparatus which in reality possesses them, they defend an apparatus over which they no longer have any control, and which is no longer, as they still believe, a means for the producers, but has become a means against the producers. Page 266. This theater, with its complicated machinery, its gigantic supporting staff, its sophisticated effects, has become a means against the producers, not least in seeking to enlist the producers in the hopeless competitive struggle in which film and radio have enmeshed it. This theater, whether in its educating or its entertaining role, both are complementary, is that of a sated class for which everything it touches becomes a stimulant. Its position is lost. Not so that of a theater which, instead of competing with newer instruments in publication, seeks to use and learn from them, in short, to enter into debate with them. This debate, the epic theater, has made its own affair. It is measured by the present state of development of film and radio, the contemporary form. For the sake of this debate, Brecht fell back on the most primitive elements of the theater. He contented himself broadly with a podium. He dispensed with wide-ranging plots. He thus succeeded in changing the functional connection between stage and public, text and performance, director and actor. Epic theater, he declared, had to portray situations rather than to develop plots. It contains such situations, as we shall see presently, by interrupting the plot. I remind you here of the songs, which have their chief function in interrupting the action. Here, in the principle of interruption, epic theater, as you see, takes up a procedure that has become familiar to you in recent years from film and radio, press and photography. I am speaking of the procedure of montage. The superimposed element disrupts the context in which it is inserted, but that this procedure has here a special, perhaps indeed a perfect right, allow me briefly to indicate the interruption of action on account of which Brecht described his theater is epic. Constantly counteracts an illusion in the audience. For such illusions, it is a hindrance to a theater that proposes to make use of elements of reality in experimental rearrangement. But it is at the end, not the beginning, of the experiment that the situation appears, a situation which, in this or that form, is always ours. It is not brought home to the spectator, but distant from him. He recognizes it as the real situation, not with satisfaction, as in the theater of naturalism, but with astonishment. Epic theater, therefore, does not reproduce situation, rather it discovers them. This discovery is accomplished by means of the interruption of sequences. Only interruption does not have here the character of a stimulant, but of an organizing function. It arrests the action in its course and thereby compels the listener to adopt an attitude vis-à-vis the process, the actor vis-à-vis his role. I should like to show you by an example how Brecht's discovery and use of the gestus is nothing other than the restoration of the method of montage decisive in radio and film from an often merely modish procedure to a human event. Page 267. Imagine a family scene. The wife is just about to grab a bronze sculpture to throw it at her daughter. The father is opening the window to call for help. At this moment, a stranger enters. The process is interrupted. What appears in its place is the situation on which the stranger's eye now falls.